Hi, Sasha. How's it going?
It's going well. How are things with you?
Good, good. I am. The cast review, the cast report came out, and God, 4 years, Hilary Cass, Dr. Hilary Cass, for anybody who doesn't know, anybody in gender world will know, 4 years, Dr. Hilary Cass and her team have been working really hard. I saw an interview with her where she said, I thought it was just going to be a few afternoons a week for about 6 months.
4 years later.
4 years later, completely consumed, 24 hours a day, and a team have worked on, you know, gender treatment. It's the largest and it's the most comprehensive and it's the most detailed report of its kind, which is gender treatment for children. And it's an independent report. It's got a stack of research with it. It is really, really going to be really, really useful for anybody who is trying to put forward that what is actually going on with gender treatment for children these days. Based in the UK, however, it's 9,000 children that they're discussing. So this is really comprehensive. And ultimately, what Dr. Hilary Cass comes out with is effectively that there is no evidence to support radical treatments. There is no evidence. The evidence base is really low. And as far as I'm concerned, now the research is in. Like when we first started GenSpect in 2021, we were very ready to kind of conceive the idea of there's lots of research. Maybe we're wrong. We don't know. We were very kind of humble in the idea of there could be all sorts we don't know about. Now that like we've all immersed ourselves for years, you and me and so many of us, I think we can say with the Cass report, we've enough research now. There comes to time, it's a great line in therapy, which is you can build evidence forever.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've built the evidence. Cass has done the evidence. The research is in. We don't like, yeah, we could have a whole stack of other pieces of research. We could spend thousands and thousands of euros on research. And all we'll ever get is with what Cass has, which is we don't have evidence to support it. So, you know, there's, you know, Bertrand Russell, the philosopher from way back in the day, he must be 100 years ago, but he used to say, you know, how can you prove that there isn't a chocolate teapot circling the earth? So arguably with gender treatment, there's something similar going on, because we can't quite prove whether gender treatment is going to be good or bad, if you follow me. It's debatable. It's very much on the person. But for people who are trying to carry out very radical, irreversible treatments on children, it's the burden of proof is on them to prove that this extraordinary treatment has enough evidence to support it. The burden of evidence should never have been on us.
Yeah.
And so Hilary Cass, by coming out with all of that work, and she ultimately says there's no evidence to support it, and that's all she can say. Because how can you prove that there? It's the burden of proof was on the wrong people, really.
Totally.
And so, yeah. And I think we need to pivot away from trying to prove anything to do with gender treatment and all that. And now just say least invasive first, back to kind of first principles, cautious approach, kind of, you know, I think that's where our emphasis should be now.
Yeah, it's really interesting because this whole thing has really shown that the advocacy groups and the activists did a very good job of putting kind of normal standards of operating on the back foot. It's very strange. And actually,
yes,
Dr. Cass in her report highlights the differences between, you know, the kind of old treatments for childhood gender dysphoria versus the affirmative model, which she recognizes was kind of born in the United States and kind of proliferated around the world, which is this idea that, you know, a child knows who they are and their declarations about gender need to be taken essentially at face value, and that the child should lead the way. Like you said, that the circling of a giant chocolate teapot, the burden of proof should always have been on the Arensafts and the affirmative model people.
Yes.
Because it's like kind of a non-falsifiable woo-woo idea. And yet for some reason, the last decade or so,
we bought into this idea.
Yeah, we've been on the back foot trying to say, and we've been accused of, and you know, Hilary Cass also in the report points out that the nature of this debate and the fear of being called transphobic and all of these kind of highly charged political statements has contributed to the difficulty in this area. And, you know, I have not read the full report. It's something like 400 pages, but I've read several kind of reviews of the report from trusted resources like Segem. I read something by Kathleen Stock. There's a New York Times piece. So there's lots of pieces coming out. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to digging into the report. But it seems like she highlights a couple of key things that are, you know, beyond the obvious, which is that the obvious being, if there's no evidence that this could be helpful and there's some evidence of risks, this is not the right treatment. That's kind of the gist of it. She also goes on to highlight that young adults are also quite vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And 18s to 25s, that older adolescent period, is a vulnerable stage. She points out that social transition is not a neutral intervention and you know, suggests extreme caution for families making the decision around social transition. She talks about the kind of using threats of suicide is totally unfounded because she points out that other mental health comorbidities can explain any elevated risks in trans-identified youth, not because of the gender itself. So like she kind of, it feels good because we've been saying these things for so long. And we've been accused by some of being these kind of transphobic conversion therapists. So it just feels really nice to be vindicated. And four years of research and eight systematic reviews that she used to look at this data. And, you know, I haven't dug into this yet, but very interestingly, I think WPATH has responded to the CAS report and accused her of being cis heteronormative or something along those lines. No surprise to us. But it does feel like such a monumentous report. And I'm hoping that the U.S. begins to recognize it is an outlier. By using the affirmative care model here in the U.S., we are becoming an outlier, like leeches or something. Like, it's so crazy what we're doing. So I hope that this report has an impact here.
And just one or two more things about the CATS report. That point you raised about, you know, that there isn't an elevated risk of suicide. The reason why these extraordinary interventions were brought in was on the basis of this is an emergency, this is life-saving. And they never would have got past the step A had they not done this heightened language. We've long established, it's an elevated risk for everybody with mental health issues, but it's no more elevated than other people with mental health issues.
Yeah.
And by using that line, all the doors got open, all the interventions opened, everything opened on this. And now we know that line is not true. We have literally, like, God bless Michael Biggs and his FOI, Freedom of Information, requests to JIDS at the Tavistock to find out that over a period of 10 years, between 2010 and 2020, 15,000 children were either being treated or they were on the waiting list, and four of those died by suicide, two of whom were on the waiting list, two of whom were being treated. And that's not an elevated risk. It's a tragedy, but it's not an elevated risk. And we have to deal with the facts when we're dealing with suicide. And so now we know that that is the case. And we know that these are experimental interventions that can lead to extreme devastation if the person regrets it. Yeah. We arguably have a very strong case to say this is not where, and certainly it's the position of Genspec now, these interventions should not be carried out in hospitals. They should be not funded by the state purse. These are not life-saving. These are not necessary. These are arguably more along the lines of cosmetic surgery, extreme body modification clinics. This is not where the public funding should be going. And I think CAS has clarified that. So we've moved out of the research stage where we were thinking, is this, could this be? And like now we know, no, that's not true. Now we have to move into a more policies around the realistic situation. And one last thing before we go on to this amazing episode that we've had with Christina Buttons, one last thing about the Hillary CAS is that we now know that we are dealing with experimental treatments that is not life-saving, and we can kind of free ourselves up to kind of act upon that. We've kind of got the research now to back mine and your position. So we're in a much stronger position now, thankfully, than ever before.
Yeah. And I mean, one last thing. she recommends psychological support, generalized psychological support. So she's actually recommending.
I loved it.
To move it out of gender and into just a more generalized standard psychological approach to things like distress, suicidality, etc. So,
and
yeah, absolutely.
The clinics do not need to have the word gender in their name.
Correct.
I completely agree. You know, it's could one day do maybe when we've read it and fully digested it, not the quick hot takes that everybody are doing. Me and you could do an analysis of just the depths of it. Maybe we might even get Dr. Hilary Cass to join us.
I'd love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about our episode with Christina. This was really big. I mean,
Christina,
yeah, she was a phenomenal episode.
Yeah.
Forthcoming also with her own experiences. Like, she got an autism diagnosis a little bit older in life, and she shared with us actually how difficult her adolescence was. And recently she also shared like some pictures on Twitter of her teenage self versus now. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see
that. But, you know, she described in this episode how she went through really dark periods. She was in all kinds of treatment facilities, which were also interesting because right now there's a kind of conversation going on in the culture about these treatment centers that are for like, you know, kids with really serious problems. And Paris Hilton apparently has got a show about a treatment center that she was in. So,
that's right.
And it was interesting to hear Christina's take on this because she neither demonized those places nor said that they were like fantastic, but she just talked about a lot about her own experiences and how she sees herself in a lot of the ROGD kids.
Yeah, I think parents who listen to this who have distressed teenagers will get a real insight into how, especially if it's a teenage girl, but any sort of deeply distressed teenager, just what it was like. There was something about Christina could remember what it was like and remember the lost days. And she's come through them. And, you know, she might have hated some of the treatment at the time, but thinks it stood to her. And that could give great heart to some people who are just, we are so frightened when our kids are distressed. And Christina is one of those lovely stories where you think, wow, if they come out anything like Christina, we'll be okay.
I know. And I mean, speaking of how Christina came out, she's a brilliant researcher and writer.
She's
done a lot of interesting research on autism. And so you'll hear us talk a little bit about this report that she's been working on. And it's not published yet, but Stella, you said she's going to talk about it in Lisbon for the GenSpec conference. Yeah. Can you say more about that?
I can't wait. You know, she gave a brilliant talk, and there was an amazing kind of impact of her talk in Denver. And that was about a detransitioner survey. She's scholarly. This woman really is a scholar. And then in Lisbon, she's coming back. She's coming to the Lisbon conference and she's going to speak about her autism report. And I think we have yet to have somebody really grapple with autism and gender. We know it. But we haven't had somebody saying, right, I'm taking it on.
Yeah.
And Christina's going to do it. And I'm absolutely thrilled.
Yeah. I'll read her bio and then we'll let you just jump into the episode. Okay. Christina Buttons is a Nashville-based investigative journalist whose writing focuses on the gender-affirming model of healthcare for a liberal audience. Her writing exposes the frivolous scholarship and pseudoscience propping up gender ideology. She's a self-declared former social justice warrior who now describes herself as politically homeless. Her educational background is in science, communication, and biology. She's illustrated 3 award-winning children's books and writes about gender, pseudoscience, mental health, autism, and critical thinking on her Substack, Buttons Lives. Her monthly newsletter, Gender Medicine Monthly, reports on the most significant updates related to pediatric gender medicine and the affirmative care model in lay terms and discusses their significance. And of course, you can find her on Twitter at Buttons Lives. And we also got into some very frivolous, juicy gossip about herself and Colin Wright, who is her partner and boyfriend. And of course, they are the kind of like hot gender couple, the smart hot gender couple. So we asked her lots of questions about their relationship and very like gender wider lens fashion. So we hope you enjoy this conversation with Christina Buttons.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Stella O'Malley, a psychotherapist in Ireland.
And I'm Sasha Ayad, an adolescent therapist in the United States.
And this is Gender, A Wider Lens, a podcast dedicated to the shifting concepts around gender in our contemporary culture.
Through in-depth interviews, personal stories, and psychological exploration, we seek to open up the discourse around this hot-button issue.
Join us as we look at gender from a wider lens.
Hi, Stella and Christina. Welcome to Gender, A Wider Lens.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I love you on Twitter. And I love you in real life, but I love your Twitter game. I love your responses. And it's great to have you because I know you've done an awful lot of important work and we hope to explore it in this episode.
Yeah, same. I love our whole community. It's great get together, you know, and see you guys at conferences and online. And, you know, it's like my family.
Me too. It's my family.
Yeah, we all feel really like a real camaraderie because it's such a weird and, you know, intense topic and it's kind of ostracized to talk about. So I definitely feel that camaraderie with people. And I mean, we'll get to this later, but your talk at the GenSpect conference in Denver was really incredible. And you actually got a standing ovation for a statement that you made that I think encapsulates this whole gender world perfectly. So we'll get to that in a bit. But as we often do, we'd love to kind of go backwards in time and ask you, what were you doing in your life when gender came on your radar, and how did you end up shifting kind of into doing this work full time?
Yeah, well, I'm, I guess, what you would call a California liberal. I voted Democrat in every presidential election since I was 18. You know, I loved Obama and I rejoiced when gay marriage was nationally recognized. But otherwise, like, I didn't spend that much time thinking about politics until the pandemic, when I was sort of inside all the time and just glued to the news for updates. I was watching MSNBC and CNN all day. And I think that's when I started getting more involved in politics online, especially. I got involved in like the online social justice art community because I'm an artist. And that led to my involvement with like this progressive Instagram account with like 750,000 followers, where I was basically like curating content for them. But, you know, it was like leftist propaganda. It was meant to keep people like engaged and outraged. And, you know, I fully believed like we were experiencing like a racism pandemic at the time. And it wasn't until like I got called a racist by a coworker for something totally benign. And one of my employers sided with this person that it led me to start questioning the ideology. Like, you know, if I'm a racist, like, what does that word even mean anymore? Like, I know I'm not a racist.
What was the benign thing?
I was hired to write jokes about Republicans, and I made a joke about Candace Owens. And then I was told by a coworker who is, you know, this infamous race baiter who's, you know, been in the news for getting people fired from their jobs and stuff. But he said that I'm not allowed to make jokes about Black people because I'm white. And I'm like, but she's a Republican. Racist. I was hired to do this. But then the employer said like, well, we're going to let a Black person decide what's racist. And I'm like, that makes no sense. This is what you hired me to do. Yeah. So that's when I started thinking about like, I got so interested in like, where are these beliefs coming from? And that's when I sort of dove into, you know, cynical theories and new discourses and like, started uncovering like, what is this critical race theory? And like, why is the media telling me one thing when it's something else? And that's when I started sort of questioning everything. Like, I had always trusted mainstream media, government, all our institutions. I thought, you know, like anybody who doubted that the mainstream narrative was like a conspiracy theorist. So I started questioning things and like peeling back the surface on other things. And it was, that's when I discovered the trans stuff. I think it was like I was just curious. There was an ACLU tweet and it said, you know, Republicans hate trans people, anti-trans legislation. And I'm like, okay, let's see, what is this really about? What is it? What I read the legislation. I'm like, this makes total sense. This isn't anti-trans. Like, what does anti-trans mean? And then I just further and further down the rabbit hole. And then you're
kind
sure.
of like the word racist, you realize it doesn't have a clear meaning. So does anti-trans. Like
exactly.
You realize. I'm curious though, because you mentioned that you were writing jokes. So I presume you were maybe writing, and it seemed like your life was very online. And you said you were an artist. So what were you doing as like a full-time job around this time?
Well, I was in school for biology, and then I had the opportunity to illustrate some children's books for a friend. So at the time I was illustrating children's books. So I was very involved with social media and, you know, promoting art for these books and stuff like that. And that's when I kind of, just got involved with the art community, social justice art. It's big. It's very lucrative.
Yeah, I bet it is. That's so interesting. So you were starting to kind of question these ideas, and that's when you came across trans and you started to read legislation that was supposedly anti-trans, and you found it to be actually quite reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then what happened?
You know, then I met Colin, and that, you know, he introduced me to our friend Buck Angel, and, you know, I learned all about gender ideology and, you know, how things have changed so much over the last, over the decade. And I read detransitioner stories, and that, you know, those really hit home. I think it was, you know, Helena's detransition story I read, and I'm like, this sounds like I'm reading my journal. This sounds just like me, because I had all these issues when I was a teenager, and I was in treatment centers and psych hospitals and hurting myself and couldn't function at home and just desperate to figure out what was going on with me so I could fix it, and trying all these different diagnoses. And I'm like, this is what's happening today. Is like a lot of young people are finding gender ideology and, you know, attributing all the distress that they're feeling to gender.
Can I ask, what generation are you? Like, you're not a millennial, right? You are a millennial. So on the young side of millennial.
I'm 35.
Oh, you are 35. Okay. Yeah. I thought you were younger. So that's interesting. So Helena is a different generation from you, but you noticed a lot of similarities in your experiences with her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have written about, and your research revolves around autism and gender dysphoria, and you've talked a little bit about your own diagnosis. Can you tell us a bit about that and how you think those traits impact things like searching for a label and struggling during adolescence? Because I think that's really important.
Yeah, I mean, that it was such a relief to finally get diagnosed. I didn't get diagnosed until I was 30, you know, by a psychiatrist. My whole life finally made sense after that. All the issues I had as a teenager, like I couldn't function in school. I was taken out of school. I had an IEP. I was in treatment centers all the time. And my life after that too, after I became an adult, was very, very difficult. And it was just, it was such a relief to finally figure out what it was. And I don't think like I could have gotten my life together and be where I am now had I not gotten that diagnosis. I was lost.
What did it do? What did having the diagnosis do for you?
I stopped beating myself up. I realized like, you know, when I was a teen and I was first diagnosed with depression, they said that I had, you know, a chemical imbalance in my brain. And everybody who talked about me, all the care providers, would talk about how I was like mentally ill. And I just always, that just stuck with me. I had very low self-esteem. I really internalized those words, and I just felt like I was just broken, and there was nothing I could do to ever get better. Mm-hmm. And that's why I just didn't drive for very much after that. Like I didn't hold myself to very high expectations. I didn't try in life. Like, I just felt like I was a loser, and I always would be. And that really changed when I got an autism diagnosis, I think.
Could I ask, did you suspect it? Like, you didn't go for no reason. Did other people suggest it? Because I know a lot of people who worry about suggesting maybe to their adult child whether they should get a diagnosis or an evaluation or whether they shouldn't. People really agonize over the pros and cons. And it seems to be so good for some people. And for other people, they kind of lean into it in a kind of dysfunctional way. Yeah, it depends on the person.
No, I totally noticed that. Like, that's the whole... Yeah. I was involved with the online autism community for a little while. And then I also came to the same conclusions, is that, you know, in the online worlds, like, people tend to lean into dysfunction because they're trying to prove themselves. They're trying to prove, like, you know, they're actually autistic. And, you know, they do these really goofy things, like, you know, they stim on camera and show, like, this is what it looks like when I'm being autistic, okay. I guess. It's not healthy for everybody to engage in those kinds of online behaviors and make it their whole personality and their whole identity. Like, I do my best to accommodate myself rather than, you know, try to get accommodations from others. Mm-hmm. I have all kinds of things that I do. Like, you know, I carry sunglasses and earplugs with me everywhere, and I just discreetly put in my earplugs when it gets too kind of like loud and overwhelming, and I don't really make a big deal about it or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just part of my experience.
Mm-hmm. And what made you go for the evaluation?
And I had started learning about it and wondering if that was what was going on, because I'd always had a lot of these issues, like with sensory experiences and balance issues and social issues. Like, I struggled to maintain friendships, gone through a lot of friendships, everything. I just, it all kind of just finally made sense when I learned more about it, what it looked like in women, and especially when I learned about, you know, why so many girls evade early diagnosis. For a long time, autism's been conceptualized as like a boy's diagnosis, and it affects boys more than girls. But part of the research that I've been doing is, you know, there are studies out there, like very large scale studies, that show that there are non-biological factors that prevent girls from getting a diagnosis. You know, there's barriers to diagnosis so they don't end up getting diagnosed usually until they're an adult.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot, because I don't know if you know this, but prior to working in gender, I worked with younger kids on the autism spectrum for many years, doing more like behavioral therapies and in-home therapies. And these were kids with really high support needs. Some of them were nonverbal. Some of them probably would never be able to live independently. And so
I did that too.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. I took care of disabled kids for a while.
Okay. So, I mean, it's really amazing work, and you learn so much about different families and how they kind of help their children who have really complicated disabilities. But, you know, now that I'm working in this world, I meet a lot of people with autism diagnoses that have much lower support needs, right? Like, you know, headphones in my ear, glasses, if I can manage the sensory overload, I'll be fine, which is really, really different from the types of kids I used to work with. So whenever I encounter a condition that does exist on a spectrum, I often feel unsure about where is appropriate to draw the line. And like, at what point does this diagnosis like help a person feel like, okay, this isn't my fault. I don't have to beat myself up. Let me just learn how to manage this condition, versus when does the diagnosis become something that can have like complicated impacts too? Like you said, some people deal with it in an unhealthy way and they do these online behaviors, but I don't know, like it's one of those things, kind of like gender dysphoria has a spectrum nature to it. Some people experience a ton of gender dysphoria, some people experience very little. But I always feel like, okay, with spectrum related conditions that are not either like, yes, you have it, or no, you don't, you can exist on this kind of continuum. It just gets a little bit tricky. And I'm wondering, you know so much about both worlds. What do you think about that? Just like the spectrum nature of the autism diagnosis.
Yeah, well, I think it was a mistake to remove Asperger's as a separate category in 2013 and merge it into a spectrum condition. And I think that's also played a role in like a lot of girls who are, you know, who have Asperger's who aren't getting diagnosed early. And it leads to a lot of psychiatric comorbidities when they don't get diagnosed early. And I think that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, TikTok too, and online social justice communities, you know, there is a lot of social contagion to it. I also think too, you know, kids today are growing up in this world of social media where we attach so much value to having a following. So I think that young people early on figure out like they have to have like a brand, you know, to attract a following.
Yeah.
So they, and you have these little bios and, you know, you put all your little identity labels in it to attract your following. And then it becomes kind of like a fixed part of you. And then you're like encouraged to, you know, produce content about that trait. And then it just sort of becomes all consuming. And it's just not very healthy. And it's interesting because, you know, I didn't grow up with social media when I was a teenager. That came more when I was an adult. But I mean, there are, you know, a lot of young people on social media today who are experiencing this like inherent value in having a large following that I think is troubling.
Yeah, you're so right about the branding. I mean, that's a pretty fascinating and contemporary issue that teenagers have. And I think teenagers have always been concerned about image. So that's nothing new. Like every generation has in high school, there's like the jocks and the emos or the goths, or I mean, there's always been that kind of image focus for teenagers. But now you have an online presence where you basically build your brand out of that. And so I think you're so insightful to point that out. And it's complicated.
We want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, GenSpect and Therapy First. GenSpect is an international organization committed to fostering a healthy approach to sex and gender. The team and members of GenSpect strive to promote high-quality, evidence-based care for gender nonconforming individuals. GenSpect is pleased to offer a non-medicalized approach to gender with their recently published Gender Framework, and they continue to hold conferences around the world. Visit genspect.org to learn more.
Therapy First is a non-profit worldwide professional association of mental health providers who view psychotherapy as the appropriate first-line treatment for gender dysphoria. Therapy First supports psychotherapists working with gender dysphoric youth and young adults and offers public education on mental health and psychotherapy. Visit therapyfirst.org to learn more.
Now, back to the show.
So to go back to your timeline, you start looking into all this gender stuff. You meet Colin, and in a very kind of selfish and nosy way, Stella and I were curious about, because I mean, if anyone doesn't know, Christina has been writing like brilliantly about gender and all of these things. And Colin is a biologist who also has an incredible Substack, and he's written so many important articles and papers about this. So you guys are a couple, and you're like, I think in our world, like a famous gender couple. Can you tell us a little bit Oh yeah.
You're like the glamour, good-looking couple of Twitter. You're both gorgeous, so we're particularly proud of you. Yes. Me and the other middle-aged women were very proud to have you. But you said you met Colin, just to add to this, but you said you met Colin. It was almost like you didn't meet on gender. You met on Twitter, but it wasn't about gender. Did you meet just kind of, you saw each other in comments or something?
It was a Clubhouse event, and it was, I think it was Barry Weiss and Paul Rossi were discussing, this was like 2021. It was affiliated with FAIR, Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism. There was like some kind of discussion after that Clubhouse event
in real life.
That Clubhouse was an app where people get together and talk in a room. It's not a video function or anything like that. It's just, you know, people, it's a lot like Twitter Spaces.
I was
today,
just about to
or
say,
X
like
spaces.
A Twitter space,
same functionality, I guess. And I saw him talking and I thought he was really cute. And then I went and checked him out on Twitter, and it's like his bio said evolutionary biology, which is, you know, one of my passions, and cats, of course, in his bio. And I'm obsessed with the cats. So I thought he was really handsome, and I slid into his DMs, and yeah, he totally just like friend zoned me. Cause I learned this later, but I mean, I was very persistent. I really liked him. So,
are you a bit stalky, Christina? As a fellow stalker.
I wasn't used to being rejected either. So I was just persistent. I just assumed like, okay, well, he's either gay or he has a girlfriend. So I just kept up with it. And then finally, I found out.
Why
like,
did he friend zone you?
Because I had purple hair, and he thought I was a social justice warrior trying to frame him.
In fairness, we've just slid over to Colin's side there. You didn't say anything with the purple hair, Christina.
I used to do my hair. I had rainbow hair, full rainbow hair.
That's so funny.
Okay. It was really cool.
So he was suspicious of your intentions. Yeah. He kind of thought you were like
Thought I was trying to get him to like say something, and then I would post it and make him look bad.
Totally.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. So at what point did he trust that you were being sincere?
Just my persistence, I guess. Like he said he was going to go to on a trip or something like that. I was like, oh, so is your like your girlfriend watching your cats? Or he's like, no, I don't have any cats. I'm like, oh, well, he has cats in his bio.
And he said, but I do.
Yeah, I do. And I finally convinced him to come and meet me. So I was staying at a castle at the time in Hollywood. I was living in this place called the Hollywood Castle, and it's like an actual castle on the top of the hill. I was renting out a room there. I had friends that owned it, and I convinced him, I lured him to come and meet me, and we had a great time and we hit it off. And just, you know, he was so tall in person. So,
so you that lured did it him to a castle. I mean, this is almost like straight out of a fairy tale. Okay.
And yeah, I mean, it was just
story.
Well, I was also kind of like in the dungeon area too. I was kind of in the dungeon, this dirty like dungeon area I was renting out. And,
So he came and saved you from a dungeon, basically.
Yeah, only
he's a
it was
real
only,
charmer.
It went it like we both just realized like when we met each other too that we were just perfect for each other, and like it moved pretty fast. We moved to Nashville. Yeah.
Did you still have purple hair?
I think it was like silver or gray. I changed it a lot, but yeah, no, when we first met it was still purple.
Wow.
And he got over it. So then you guys moved to Nashville. Well, I mean, I always think about like in my life I don't have gender conversations that much, because basically I try to spare all of the people around me from like listening to me talk about this.
Yeah.
But then I think, I wonder if Christina and Colin just talk about this stuff 24/7, like over dinner every night.
Oh, we do.
And like, yeah. I bet.
Yeah. Oh, it's, I mean, we both just are working on this issue constantly, because for me, it's my special interest, and he's also very, very focused and dedicated to it as well. And it's just, yeah, it's all we talk about. Besides,
it's all me and Henry talk about. Like, God bless him. Henry talks a bit about his building, and I'm like, yeah, yeah. And I used to talk a lot about his buildings, and now we go straight to gender. Yeah, we're probably not as healthy as you, Sasha.
Do you have a life outside of gender, Sasha?
I think she does.
I think I do have a life outside of gender, and it's probably because, like, my fiance's responses to things are just, he has like four responses. He goes, "Wow, that's fucked up," or he goes, "That's crazy," or he goes, "What? That's weird." Like, he doesn't have a lot more to add. I mean, he thinks everything is crazy, but he, you know, he's not like, "Oh my God, then what happened?" Yeah. Like, so it just kind of keeps the conversations to a minimum.
I had an interesting episode this week that I thought gave me a very good insight into the kind of, you know, the normies, the disengaged who just don't get there. So I was invited to something in Parliament in Ireland, and it was very interesting, but the politician who invited me didn't really know much about gender. And after, because he saw, you know, all these trans people talking about these really awful stories, it was pure trans kind of pain as such. Afterwards, he was really shook, and you could see he just wanted to get away. If you follow me, he just wanted to get away. And I had the same response, Christian. I was like, wow. He just was like, too heavy, too strange, too exotic, too weird for me. Just too weird for me. I could just see it. He just couldn't get away fast enough. And I thought, that's what's going on with a lot of the disengaged. They just want to get the hell away from the conversation.
Too much. Yeah.
Yeah. I could see it. And he had goodwill, but he was just like, Anyway, let's go back to Christina.
I want to ask you something, Christina, because you've talked about how, if you've written about how, like, if you were a kid today, you think you would have also gotten wrapped up in the trans identity. Would you be willing to share a little bit more about that? Like, what do you think would have been appealing to you? And I mean, obviously, how do you think that would have gone?
I was very gender nonconforming growing up. I liked boy things. I got along better with boys. I had a lot of difficulty making friends with girls and maintaining the friendships. And, you know, I had very low self-esteem. I hated my body. Like, I was like very flat-chested, and I was like body dysmorphic about like the level of obsession I had over that. And just, I felt like, you know, it would not have taken much convincing if someone had said to me, like, "Have you thought about maybe that you're really a boy?" Oh, like, my, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-old minds, I mean, I would have latched onto that idea and just not been able to let it go. From everything that I've read and talked to detransitioners about, like, it was a similar experience for them as well. But I was very depressed. I had a very unusual teen experience, more so than like the typical teen. I spent most of my, when I was 15, I spent like more time, I was just constantly in and out of treatment centers and programs. And then I wound up in like the troubled teen industry and in a long-term residential treatment center in Utah for a year and 2 weeks. Same one that Paris Hilton is trying to shut down. I don't actually agree that it should be shut down. It's a last resort for a lot of families. Like, the alternative is juvenile hall. And I didn't enjoy the experience at all. Like, it was hell. But, you know, like, it serves a purpose, these places. Like, they're not supposed to be enjoyable.
How did it help, or how does it help? Because I know parents agonize over whether to send their last resort kid to places like
that. You know, when I think back about it now and what I learned there were things I learned there in this treatment center. It was Provo Canyon School that I didn't get from the kinds of therapy I was receiving in California. Like it was in Utah. So it's like, it was very centered on being accountable for your actions. Like you got yourself here. You can get yourself out. You just have to put in the work and, wow. and get better. And it, you know, that I was very resistant to that for, I think, like the first 3 months. And then I was just like, I have to get out of this place. Like, it was very militarized. Like, we were mm-hmm. called by a number, not a name. We were, you know, the punishments were pretty severe.
Like what? Can you share with us?
Yeah. Well, you get these things called infractions. And if you get a certain number of them per week, then you have to go and sit for 5 hours in this place called short term, where you have to sit perfectly still in like chairs. They called it chair structure. And if you like talked or if you did anything disruptive, then they add more time and more time. And if you were really bad, like you basically would, they would send you up to like the third floor, what was called investment, where it was basically you had to do that just all day. Is just sitting perfectly, working on something. God. Yeah. And then, you know,
for the people awful.
Who, oh yeah, it was an enjoyable experience at all. It was pretty terrible. I had nightmares about it after I left. Cause I would, you know, I'd be over 18 and I would have dreams all the time where I'd be back there.
Oh my
so you're
God.
Not allowed to go outside. You're not allowed to do anything. You can't even look outside for the first few months while you're there. Everything is on schedule.
Is this a punishment? Is this for delinquents, like for teenagers?
It's like there's like a level system. So it's like a level apart from like juvenile hall, where it's like that's the next place. So it is, it's, you know, to help with behavioral issues and stuff like that. Like, I didn't feel like I, you know, was like a lot of the other kids that, you know, maybe needed to be there, but you know, I was there. I couldn't. All I could do was try to survive it, and I did. But the lessons I learned from it about personal responsibility and being accountable for your own actions is, I think, a better framework than, you know, some other practices that try to say everything is, you know, somebody else's fault, where you don't take any personal responsibility.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, that's so interesting that you say that, because I've been thinking a lot about how the mental health world, and particularly like pop psychology, mental health regards things like consequences and trauma and these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And you said something really interesting. You said that I learned certain things from this place that I wouldn't have gotten other places. And I recently did this video for my membership group where I talk about stress perception. I don't know if you've heard about this concept, but basically they found, like, research has found that our beliefs about stress can impact whether or not we do well under stress. So if you go into, let's say, a treatment setting thinking, this is going to traumatize me, I will be destroyed by this, I will never come out of this alive, that can impact how resilient you are. Versus if you go into something like you said, I got to get out of here, I have to get myself out of this place, I have to, you know, figure out how to survive this, you have more of like an action-oriented
yes.
kind of perspective. So it's just super interesting to hear you say that, because it seems like Paris Hilton's perspective is this place should not exist, it's just destructive. And your perspective is, it was hell, but I learned things that I wouldn't maybe have otherwise figured out. So
yeah.
What do you think about that?
And I mean, like, I don't know if I would have been, if I'd still be alive if I hadn't gone there either. Like, it was...
Wow. Were you struggling with like self-harm and stuff?
Because uh-huh.
you don't. Okay. Yeah.
I had an eating disorder. I was cutting myself. I was trying to kill myself. I was wow. just, I couldn't function in a home environment anymore. So it was like, you know, she's a danger to herself. She needs a higher level of care. Mm-hmm. That's how I ended up there. But what you're saying about belief, like, that's kind of what's been interesting about all this gender stuff and gender ideology, is I think so much about like how our beliefs shape everything, you know. Yeah. I mean, the ideology part, like the nature of belief, it's mm-hmm. so fascinating. And it's also just opened up, you know, I wonder about all these other diagnoses too. The whole field of psychiatry is a little bit suspect, like
awful.
Some more than others, but how certain things are conceptualized and how people believe that they have certain diagnoses because they're, you know, written about and studied, and you know, they look at the symptoms and they think, oh, I have this or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
It's been.
Could I ask you something? I'm looking forward to us going on to talk about, you know, your talk in Denver and the research you've done, and you know, there's so much there. But I just want to ask one last question around that period. You know, I've read Abigail Schreier's new book, Bad Therapy, and you know, I'm
halfway through it.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. We're probably at the same place, Christina. Yeah,
and I'm thinking of about. What was the home background that you came from? And then you went to this very strict background. And I'm wondering, where are you coming from the background that Abigail is particularly kind of zeroing in on, which is kind of, I suppose, listen to your feelings, let yourself be led by your emotions. And it's a lot of love, but it's leading to an awful lot of emotional
right.
dysregulation.
It's too much focus on feelings, I think. I liked that she talked about that in the book, is when you prioritize like feelings, that was what my problem was when I was a teenager, was I was so focused on trying to figure out what's wrong with me that I wasn't focused on, you know, things that I could be doing that would boost my self-esteem, like any like achievements that I could be making. Like I could have learned a musical instrument and that would have like, when I got good at it, it would have helped my self-esteem, but I was so focused on like finding out like a diagnosis or an identity or something to explain myself. And I was always, people were always asking me about feelings, and it became so much of my headspace was devoted to that, when it just didn't really matter. I could have been doing things that made me feel, would have led to me feeling much better about myself. And then I wouldn't have felt like there was something wrong with me. Just the focus on that is totally wrong.
It's like too far east is west. It's like we went from kind of putting all the emotions under the carpet, you know what I mean? Stiff upper lip. And then we've swung over to emotions, bring them on, ruminate, think about
them. Yeah.
And we need to kind of come back from that.
Especially, you know, if you have autism, it means you have a natural propensity to kind of get stuck on something over and over in kind of loop. And, you know, then you mix that with adolescence, our hormones are raging, and emphasizing feelings and thinking about feelings and analyzing feelings and trying to figure out the feelings, that can be a real recipe for disaster. So I'm so glad we got to touch on this, but you're right, Stella, let's get back to your research. So how long have you spent now researching the question of autism and gender dysphoria? It's been a while, because you talked about it in Denver in the Johns Hopkins conference.
I was always interested in autism research, but this time, like around this time last year, is when I really began looking at the kind of intersection between autism and gender dysphoria.
What stood out to you? Like any surprising findings that you want to share?
Yeah. So, I mean, while I've been a journalist for a few years now that almost like exclusively covers this issue, I've gotten to interview a lot of detransitioners. And I spoke to so many of them who, you know, after getting an autism diagnosis in adulthood, realized like that explained their experiences so much better than gender dysphoria did, and it led to them to detransition. So I thought, like, this is population really needs to be studied. I know that all the current research on autism and gender dysphoria is looking at people who currently identify as transgender, and there's virtually nothing about autistic detransitioners. So I felt like it was really important to that needed to be discussed. And it just ties in so much with my own story, where I think that they're, you know, it's mostly like teenage girls who are showing up to gender clinics today. And I feel like at least some proportion of them are probably young girls who, you know, haven't yet received an autism diagnosis, or if they have, like, they're maybe attributing their experiences to gender when they're actually, like, maybe better understood as, like, an autistic trait. And there's just so much overlap between the autism traits and the symptoms of gender dysphoria. And, you know, they're diagnosed based on behavior and, you know, self-assertions. So it's very easy to, you know, interpret your experiences as gender dysphoria because they have so much, like, they have so much, so many identity issues and issues with their body. And I could maybe share some of the findings from the survey.
Please do. Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
I've seen some of your work, Christina. It's so comprehensive. It's forensic. It's really, really high quality. I know you worked on, you know, Joe Berger brought in a lot of your work for the gender framework for the,
yes,
you know.
That was fun to write. The risk factors.
It was really, it's a serious document. And we're polishing it up and putting it out for peer review to launch the full version in September in Lisbon. That's the big process. That's that
exciting.
It is exciting. But I can attest to your fabulous, really, really, really impressive work. It's, you know, you wear it lightly, but you really are brilliant at this.
Thank you.
But yeah, please do tell us some of the things that you, just any of the highlights that you noticed from the research.
So I did a survey on 94 detransitioners and desisters, and I administered the autism spectrum quotient screening tool to the first time to this population. And what I found is that about like 73% of the survey participants had either an autism diagnosis or autistic traits measured by the screening tool. But this unfortunately isn't really like a representative sample of the whole population because there was some like selection bias when I was recruiting for the survey. I asked specific people that I knew were autistic to take it. So that kind of distorted those results. I'd love to be able to do it on a larger sample without the selection bias, but
okay.
That part has been very interesting. And it's for the people who did have an autism diagnosis, there was only about like 20% around that who received it under 10 years old, 10 or under, which is the ideal range that you would want to. It's before, you know, they have puberty and they experience all these social difficulties and life becomes just so much harder. For these
autistic
kids. What
was the sex
kids.
Ratio of the respondents?
It was about 80 to 20.
Female to male.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which kind of tracks because we know that women who end up with autism diagnoses as adults often don't get diagnosed till their adolescence. Isn't that correct? That's my understanding in the general population. That like adult women with autism diagnoses sometimes have not been diagnosed until they were teenagers.
Usually not until they're an adult. So
okay, yeah, okay.
And I think one estimate that I include in my report is it's almost like 80% don't get diagnosed until adulthood.
Oh.
And it leads to like severe psychiatric difficulties. Because you know you're different from everybody else. You know you don't function at the level of your peers. And you have all these social difficulties and they've really like internalized that and they feel so self-conscious. And we have, you know, large scale studies that find that, you know, in childhood, you have about like 4 to 5 males per female who get their autism diagnosis. And then later on, that number goes down to like 2 to 1. So we know that there are like non-biological factors that are preventing girls from getting diagnosed earlier. And so there's a lot of good research on this now that it's included in my report about how, you know, the diagnostic criteria was better able to detect boys. And we found that there's sort of like a female autism phenotype. They just have different experiences and different interests. They're not like, their interests aren't so much about like objects or systems or trucks mm-hmm. or trains and things like that. They're more like, you know, social interests, but they become very, very, you know, obsessive about mm-hmm. them. That mm-hmm. was my experience too growing up. Just, I went from like interest to interest like that just for a year or two at a time.
Can you give examples? Like what kinds of interests?
I think Lord of the Rings was a big one when I was like 12. And it was just, you know, my escape from the world. Yeah. I found like the real world to be very difficult. And mm-hmm. that was my retreat from everything. And I just wanted to live in this fantasy world. And I think I taught myself how to write in Elvish.
Cool.
Loved I think that's so cool. Books.
Can you touch on that before we keep going with your research? What is the relationship between autism and deep immersion in a fantasy? Because this is something we see a lot, particularly you said you're an artist too. Like a lot of the kids who are struggling with gender are incredibly creative. They get totally immersed in these fantasy worlds. And I have some theories about what that might tell us about their dysphoria, but can you say a little bit more about that? Because this is a common pattern.
It's an escape. It's like just a way to disengage from the real world because it's, you know, not interesting, but also it's just difficult to deal with. And then, you know, you find others online who have the same interests with you and you just nerd out together. And that's sort of my understanding of it.
What else can you tell us about your research?
One of the major differences between autistic detransitioners and then autistic people who currently identify as trans is when they detransition, they understand that gender identity became a kind of special interest for them, whereas they don't recognize it as that while they currently. Wow. Identify as transgender.
Is there any way to tell somebody who might be hyperfixating, they might have autistic traits and they might be hyperfixating, it might be their special interest, gender identity. Is there any way to tell them this is your special interest? If you follow me.
Well, I was hoping that like when I released this report and the data that I had that other people would be into to see it that way. It was 85.3% of the transitioners who either had an autism diagnosis or scored 26 and higher on the autism spectrum quotient. So it was like, you know, about 85% mm-hmm. said gender identity and transgender issues became a special interest. Yeah. And it was just all consuming for them. And it was, you know, I asked them a bunch of other types of similar questions about, you know, like black and white thinking. It's rigid thinking is something that's also common with autism. 90% said they recognize the tendency towards black and white thinking and that this thinking pattern often led them to view being transgender as the cause of all their issues and transitioning as the solution to all their problems. And when once they latched on to the idea, they found it very difficult to consider alternatives. And so those were some of the other findings from the survey, but I guess that kind of leads to, you know, one of the most important findings from the survey was the statement that I made that got the applause. And it has to do with like, yeah, it has to do with how transgender is conceptualized for these people who got these medical interventions were affirmed, you know, immediately. This is 95% were immediately affirmed in their trans identity by their mental health professional medical doctor. That's what I asked a bunch of questions about their interactions with healthcare professionals because they felt like there was really lacking kind of in the current research. Like I wanted to know, like, what are they telling you that made you want that? Because there's so much authority, you know, our doctors have so much authority over us. We trust them. Like we trust their expert medical opinion. And so I wanted to know what they were saying. Sorry, did you want to?
Yeah, I was going to say, did you want to read out? That was such a powerful statement, and you got your standing ovation. Did you want to read out the statement that you said? Because you, it was in the middle of the talk. It was in Denver, and it was kind of it's a brilliant point, and it needs to be kind of put on billboards, really. Do you have it handy?
I'd love to put it on a billboard.
Yay. Let's do a billboard campaign.
This is something that people just don't, they aren't understanding. And then once I explain it to them and once I tell them the statistic that I got from the survey, like they realize like, oh, this isn't like a sound medical practice. This is, because a lot of people, I mean, will still say like, oh, well, they still like knew what they were doing. They gave informed consent or whatever. They had to know, like, just because, you know, they regret it now, but like they knew what they were getting into at the time. But I found that that's not true. I found 85.7% said their healthcare providers, the professionals in their life, their mental health professionals and doctors, they led them to believe that they were born transgender. They had no control over it. They had a medical condition that required medical intervention. You know, there's no evidence to support that. There's no evidence to support like this biological basis for like this innate gender identity that is basically like the justification for transitioning children that's used today. Yeah. Like there's
it's a misleading premise in the first place. So what was the famous line? Can you say it? Do you have it there?
Oh yeah. I said, no one, neither children nor adults can give informed consent to a medical treatment if their doctor is misinforming them about the nature of their condition.
Yeah.
And I asked a few follow-up questions too about this where, because I've been very interested in all of the like, what research is out there that allows these doctors to make these claims that people are born transgender and that it's not a psychiatric condition with a high rate of desistance. I asked about, you know, the brain sex stuff, and it's 50% said that their healthcare provider told them they either had a male brain in a female body or a female brain in a male body. And, you know, another like 27% couldn't remember exactly if that was used, but 50% said that they definitely heard that and they conceptualized their trans identity that way. I'm like, if I was in their position, if I thought like I have a medical condition and my doctor is saying I need this medical treatment, I was born this way, I can't do anything about it. Like, of course I'm going to medically transition.
Yeah.
Like that's not, they're not even being provided an alternative. They're not told this is a psychiatric condition that, you know, for a lot of people is temporary. They're not given the option.
Yeah. Or even that, frankly, there are massive debates between philosophers, academics, lawyers, therapists, trans people about what it even means to be trans. Like there is no consensus on any of this. I mean,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Activists have really pushed and de-emphasized the importance of a gender dysphoria diagnosis and something, you know, that is persistent from when they were a child. They've pushed for this, you know, conceptualization of trans as an innate gender identity. And, you know, it's so shady. Like what the stuff that gets passed off as research today, like the studies on that supposedly find like a region in the brain that structurally resembles the opposite sex for trans patients. But, you know, these studies don't control for confounding variables like same sex attraction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, worked with someone who's looked into all these studies in depth. And, you know, that's basically what a big part of the problem is, that and like hormone use. Like there's a lot of things that can alter the appearance of the brain, and we shouldn't be reading too much into these studies anyway. But
20 years ago, the whole thing was brains are malleable, the plasticity, neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly we've slumped this kind of concept in from nowhere.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time looking at all these articles where people are reading that they're like, trans people are who they say they are. The study says so. And that's really where a lot of the problem is people conceptualize it the same way as like being gay. Like you're born gay, but like, a lot of times these gay kids and autistic kids are gender nonconforming growing up, and they're sort of interpreting their gender nonconformity as a sign that they have some kind of underlying trans identity. And doctors are just telling them, yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. You're trans. Yeah. Here's some medical interventions.
We hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as we are. We just wanted to take a quick moment and say thank you to all of our listeners. Your support helps us to keep the lights on and the mics hot.
We recently made the switch to Substack so we could build a more robust listener community. Visit widerlenspod.com and check out the different subscription tiers.
For just $8 a month, premium subscribers get access to weekly bonus content, discussion posts, and more.
And founding members get the inside track on who's coming up on the show, with the ability to submit their own questions for our esteemed guests.
For those of you who are in need of parenting support and resources, we each have parent coaching membership groups. Plus, you can buy our book, When Kids Say They're Trans.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe, and get involved in the lively discourse in the comments section.
Thank you so much. Now, back to the show.
We're coming towards the end of this bit, and when we move over to the exclusive content, I'd love to hear any thoughts you might have of how to kind of, you know, interact with somebody who might be an autistic lost teenager who needs a hand, if you follow me, because you've been there and you got through and you've come through amazingly from all those days. And, you know, your research and your experiences make you, you've kind of the full Monty, really. But before that, is there anything that you're watching or reading, any podcasts or films or books or research that you'd love to turn our audience on to?
Yeah, I'm reading Bad Therapy, Abigail Schreier.
That's
right.
Yeah,
we're a friend of that.
And you know, Colin and I, when he visited, we had Shabbat dinner with her, and you know, she told us what her secret was to like getting books written, and she said saying no and turning things down so that you can focus on your work. And that's how she's gotten two amazing books out so far.
Really has.
Unless she had one before that I don't know about, but I think that's great advice.
Irreversible Damage was her first book, which was such an amazing book. So that is great advice. Saying no to things.
I think about it all the time. I think there's so much to do, and there's so few people in this space really working on it behind the scenes, like things that we don't, you know, necessarily always get credit for, because it's not about the credit. It's about making progress on the issue. And there's just so much to do all the time. And it's like, I have to decide which things.
Well, we're so glad you said yes to us. We're super, super glad.
Yeah, I could never turn down a chance to talk to you guys.
Oh, thank you, Christina. You're really amazing, because like the story you shared with us, I hadn't heard much about your story, just like your adolescence and stuff. And you can tell that you bring a lot of sensitivity and like personal experience to your energy and like the dedication that you have writing about this topic. So it's really great to have your voice, and thank you so much. We'll be sure to link.
I care about these people. Like they just deserve better. They deserve better treatment than this.
I know.
The ones that were struggling with their gender and their all the other psychiatric issues, people deserve better than the gender affirming model of care.
Well, 100%.
Good for you.
Well, thank you, Christina. We'll be sure to share all of your work in the notes, and maybe we'll shift over into our special Substack episode, okay?
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on Gender, A Wider Lens.
If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And be sure to visit us on Substack by going to widerlenspod.com. There you can join our listener community, access bonus content and resources, plus learn about additional ways to support the show.
Our discussions are for educational purposes and are not intended as a substitute for mental health services.